part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time. I'm gonna do it part. Fanboy.com.
Well, here we go. Another wonderful episode of Part-Time Fanboy.
Yep.
My name is Christian Horn.
I'm Paul Stephen Edwards.
Paul Stephen Edwards. Well, then I am Christian Hans Horn to you, sir. Very fine and fancy. And this week, we are here to talk about something very special, which I think is actually very special. I mean, I enjoyed it very much. We're kind of in documentary mode for the next couple of weeks. And
yeah.
We saw a documentary. I can't remember exactly what date it was playing at the Egyptian, but it is entertainment and comic themed, and it is called The Death of Superman Lives. What happened? And why don't you tell the listeners a little bit what this documentary is about?
Well, wow. It's a convoluted story, but essentially what happened is that there was nearly a Superman movie directed by Tim Burton. Yes. And written initially by Kevin Smith, but it went through a few other hands. And this is a pretty comprehensive story of what went wrong, why this movie never really took off.
Yes. And it's interesting because you would sort of think that starting at the point of Nicolas Cage as Superman would be kind of like all you need, you know what I mean? But
well, you know, Nicolas Cage at the time, to be fair, was not the Nicolas Cage that we have now. You know, he was a much bigger star, you know, he hadn't quite developed the propensity for weirdness that we know and love.
He was always weird. Oh, I gotta pull up Nicolas Cage's IMDb because he had done like what's it called, Black Kiss or Spider's Kiss, or maybe he wasn't as weird as he is now, but he was definitely always a quirky actor, right?
Oh, you know? I mean, well, you know, from the beginning, you know, he had Vampire's Kiss is the one you're
Vampire's Kiss.
Yeah, and that was one of his first roles, and that sort of set the tone for for somebody who is just really offbeat. But the thing is, you know, Vampire's Kiss is a good movie, you know, and it's a good performance for what the movie was.
Absolutely. And here's the thing is, I do not want anyone to think that I don't think that Nicolas Cage, even to this day, to a certain extent, is a really good actor. I mean, I thought he did a really good job in Kick-Ass. You know, he made a really interesting choice and he kind of stuck with it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, in my acting years, like in the 90s, like he was definitely somebody that you looked up to. He was somebody that this is Nicolas Cage. He is a big talent. But I think that when this Superman movie was being developed, called Superman Lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they were sort of piggybacking off of the events of the Death of Superman comics, which we can talk about that later.
Yeah, that's another whole can of worms there.
But I think that when this was being developed, this was pre, like, Nicolas Cage, like, kind of wannabe forced down our throats action star, right? Like,
he didn't really become technically like an action star until like
the Rock.
Sort of 1-2 punch of The Rock and Con Air. Followed closely by Face Off. And I guess a funny story is I guess that like the day that he wrapped off of Con Air, 12 hours later, he was on the set of Face Off. I mean, it's like a crazy, the dude kept up a crazy schedule for a while there. But this was actually, you know, the Superman thing was sort of pre that.
Yeah.
And it's an unusual choice.
Oh, my God.
He definitely loves Superman. I mean, that is just...
Well, he loves comics, right?
Right. He loves comics, and he particularly loves Superman.
Does he? Is he really? I think, yeah, he probably... I think at one point it may have even been rumored, or it may be fact, that he had an issue of Action Comics number one, right?
Yeah, and
I think Patricia Arquette, like, made him sell it or something, or, like, sell his comic book collection or something. I don't know. That's all unsubstantiated, but... yeah, you're right. He at the very least was, I don't know if he still is, a big comic book fan, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, definitely. Yeah. He really loves
so he's
that.
One of
and
us.
I mean, let's face it. He loves Superman enough that he named his son Kal-El.
That's true, Kal-El. It doesn't get much crazier than that, which, you know, just to let you know that was if I had had a boy, that mm-hmm. was the name at the top of the list.
And my wife was like, "No." So, I mean, look, you've got a fellow kid. I mean, look, the dude loves Superman. It's clear. Is he the first choice for Superman? That's another thing. Although,
let's go back in time a little bit.
When you watch this movie, yeah. you sort of start to see what he was going for, and it's really interesting how, like, you know. It's, you know, if the saying is true about, like, the road to hell being paved with good intentions.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody seems to have approached this movie really with good intentions.
Except for John Peters, right?
Well,
and we can get into that a little bit later.
That's a whole, again,
yeah,
another whole can of worms because, like, that guy's intentions, like, I don't know if his intentions go beyond good and evil, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, here's the thing. Let's go back in time a little bit to...
Let's do it.
To, like, when getting the TARDIS, step
okay.
back with us, and go back to, like, when you first heard rumors of this. Like, this had to be after, like, the second Batman movie, right? Which
right.
was the one with Michelle Pfeiffer. Why am I blanking out on the name of it now?
Batman Returns.
Batman Returns. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So even at that point, Tim Burton had sort of, like, you know, proved that he couldn't stay out of the sort of weird zone, even with Batman, like when he introduced the Penguin. As much as I really love elements of Batman Returns, like, I love the Catwoman stuff, like,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of stuff in there that when I went to see it, but, you know, the Penguin stuff's a little strange, you know, especially for something that kids are gonna go see, you know.
Let's face it, when he, you know, If you were in any doubt about it when you had, like, the funeral march of the Penguins that sort of removed any doubt that this was, like, you know, just a surreal, strange movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, you know, at that point, it's sort of like, you know, and the thing is, like, you can't deny that Tim Burton really, like, at least the cinematic version of Batman, right? Like, and, you know, whatever other, you know, animation or whatever, he kicked that in the ass. Like, he got
it
moving, right?
And I mean, we owe the modern comic book movie to Tim Burton.
Yeah,
in a
absolutely.
Big way.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So that's the thing. But at the same time, he was picked for Batman for a reason, right? Like, I mean, because he is that sort of, like, goth, artistic, you know what I'm saying?
Right,
and
right.
those are not necessarily the, you know, things that you think of when you're thinking about Superman. So when it first got announced that Tim Burton was going to direct Superman, I remember in the 90s, you know, being a diehard comic book fan and being, you know, into entertainment and acting
right.
and all that stuff, thinking, like, no. This just
yeah,
doesn't seem
yeah.
right. You know
and,
what I mean?
And when you look at the documentary, you know, Burton's reason for getting into Superman was pretty much, you know, I think I can do better than what I did with Batman and Batman Returns, which is, you know, sort of a, you know, it's a good idea. But at the same time, like, one of the things that sort of becomes clear with me is that he never really quite had the same passion for Superman as he did for Batman.
Oh, no, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing is like you say, like, maybe I can do better with this, but the thing is like, better at what? At your own aesthetic? Or better? Because the thing is like, when you create something that's Superman, Batman, Captain America, Iron Man, whatever, you know, there's a certain aesthetic that you sort of have to adhere to. You have to look at what the source material is, and you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to follow it like in concrete form, but there are certain aspects of it. And especially like watching this documentary, you start to see them, you know, sort of beginning to develop their, you know, quote unquote, own Superman, right?
Right,
you
know? Right.
And it's, you know, and it very much, in some really good ways, diverges from the comics, and in some really bad ways, like,
Diverges, I mean, you know, part of it was like sort of the insistence on sticking with the death of Superman that Warner Brothers really wanted to do. I mean, they really wanted to stick with that because it was such a huge seller in the comics world at the time. That,
well, it was like the biggest selling comic like of all time, right? Like,
I mean, it was crazy. I mean, I remember people like who didn't really like comics going out and buying copies of The Death of Superman. Like, it was just a really big, big event, you know? And this is, you know, again, pre-internet, really. But like, this was just sort of a big media event. It's like, oh my God, they're killing Superman, you know?
And
of course, you know, we hadn't we hadn't experienced, you know, at that time, the fact that like everything always comes back to life. I mean,
comic fans, I think most people
were really like, oh shit, they're killing Superman, like, that's, you know, like, death, like, that's the end, right? We all knew that there would be a relaunch as comics fans, but I think in the big picture of things, people weren't sure that it would be, you know, that he would be coming back, you know?
And for anyone who needs a rundown of that particular story, Max Landis, the writer of, one of the writers of Chronicle, did an amazing short film, like, describing that whole event, like the death and return of Superman.
Oh, yeah.
And how it affected comics and just how crazy the storyline was, and utterly ridiculous, in my opinion.
Yeah, so, and it's interesting, too, because that storyline sort of... it sort of encapsulates like everything that started to go wrong.
You know,
Like, it's just sort of over the top. It's like, it's weird. The continuity on it's weird. Like, there's just some crazy designs. There's not a lot of attention paid to character in any of the stuff. I mean, it's it's plot, you know, it's stuff happening.
Yeah.
And, so their insistence on sticking to that storyline probably didn't help them.
Yeah, especially since that storyline in the actual comics, you know, went on forever, resulted in like four alternate Supermen, you know, and just was a mess. I mean, it was a mess. It was one of those crossovers that you know, to this day, comic book fans hate, where it's like, I have to buy every single book of like four different kinds of comics to be able to stay on top of. Mm-hmm. And it also seemed like, to a certain extent, where like the teams were not exactly communicating with each other like all that well. And it was like, this was happening in one book, and then this was happening. And they were all Superman books. That's the thing. He probably had like three or four.
Yeah, there were at least four different Superman books that were running at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you had like spillover into the other books. And I mean, the only reason why it's not hated to the degree that it probably should be now is because of the Spider-Clone saga.
Yeah, the Spider-Clone saga definitely took some heat off of the death of Superman. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's really funny because I remember even when it was happening, you know, for anyone who doesn't know or who hasn't listened to the podcast, like Superman for a very long time, up until like several years ago, up until the New 52, was literally my favorite comic book character, my favorite superhero character, you know what I mean? And I've always said, not necessarily because of the comics themselves, but mostly what the character was supposed to like represent. And a lot of that is, you know, I've realized as I've grown up, a lot of that is really, you know, informed through the original Christopher Reeve Superman movie, which, you know, to me, a lot of people had Star Wars, which I obviously thought was great as well, you know, when I was a little kid. But Superman was the movie that really just like was like a thunderclap, like, to me. in my tiny, like, 5-6-year-old brain whenever that came out. So for me, like, Superman is a comic book character that I've loved, but it is one of those things where I've had to grit my teeth and bear it for like years and years and years, because it just seemed like nobody knew what to do with him. So yeah. Then when you get to a movie that, you know, it seems like people are trying to like rewrite history, you know, like the death of Superman was like such a great story, and it's like, no, it wasn't. It was a terrible, horrible mess, and they were trying to take that and condense it into about 2 hours, you know,
right,
what I'm saying?
Right. And then, you know, and again, to sort of go back to the, I mean, that's just on the comics end of it. I mean,
yeah,
it's interesting. This whole project is sort of like the conflux clusterfuck of like a bunch of different things that are going on in comics and that are going on in the movies. And I mean, it all just sort of comes together into this like black hole of craziness.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the rights to Superman, had fallen sort of into limbo. I mean, you had the Salkins, who had done, you know, those first two incredible Superman movies, and then you had Superman 3, was a problematic. And then by the time Superman 4 came along, I mean, it was canon films, you know, like, and that sort of says it all.
Yeah.
And they were trying to do another one, you know, right after Superman 4, but Cannon went to bankruptcy.
Yeah.
The rights went back to the Salkins, and then it ended up, like, sort of up in the air. And that's when John Peters managed to get a hold of the film rights to Superman.
Yes.
Back in, like, 93.
Yes. And, you know, having such a huge success with Batman, you know, he figured he could take that character and, you know, just keep going, right?
Yeah. And yeah. I think a huge reason why this necessarily didn't work is the difference between someone like John Peters having the rights to the character versus the dude who had Batman.
Michael
Uslan, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Michael Uslan, like, definitely had, like, sort of a vision for the long term.
Yeah.
That character.
Yeah.
And whereas I think, you know, I mean, dude, I'm trying to read John Peters' mind here, and like, that's
good luck with that.
Exactly. I don't think that he necessarily had like an idea for the character long term as much as he's just like, wow, this is going to make a really spectacular movie with lots of stuff blowing up.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting because you mentioned that this was sort of like a big clusterfuck of like different things, and it's, you think back on the 90s, and the 90s was really kind of like this last gasp of like big movie stars, like big giant producers who just like had monster like power, could do whatever they wanted, you know, I mean, this is the era of people like getting $20 million salaries.
Oh yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And you would hear it, you would read Variety or the Hollywood Reporter, and it was the era of like producers just like people getting Esther House getting like millions of dollars for just like writing a one page treatment of of stuff.
And let's face it, I mean, that no one buys treatments anymore in Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a good reason.
Yeah, I mean, and so there's this era of sort of like big filmmaking, like with big money and kind of like gluttony, you know, like in Hollywood, you know, and it was very much sort of the last era of where I think people thought, we need a star, you know, like the big thing with me, especially when I was acting, was like, why do all these movies think they need a star in the lead role? Because for me, it's like Hollywood creates the stars and then they perpetuate that monster going down by, you know, being like, oh, this is our guy. And it's like, but wait, you forgot that there's a director and there was marketing and there was publicity. You know, you make like, you know, so, and if you have something like Superman, you know, obviously that almost sells itself, right? So it's just weird that, you know, they would need somebody like Michael, I was going to say Michael Keaton, Nicolas Cage, you know, to be Superman. You know what I mean? This
right.
is an era where they had forgotten, you know, that so many people had gotten wrapped up in million-dollar salaries that they just kept perpetuating that ridiculous cycle of gluttony, and more money got poured into things. And I mean, you listen to some of the money that got poured into the, you know, the death of Superman, and it's like astounding.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, by the time the thing finally did come to the screen, which is as the Superman Returns movie.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it had just an enormous budget on the thing, but a lot of the movie's budget was like stuff, you know, that was attached to the previous previous things, because there were I went through on the Wikipedia thing and counted it, and there were like 5 failed Superman attempts before they even got to Superman Returns.
That's counting the
canon one. I mean I know that kind of doesn't really count, but you know, yeah, whatever. But the it's interesting that every single one of them was all centered around the idea of like Superman dying. For some reason, like, that was just like the thing that was like stuck in the head in the 90s. Superman's dying. And I think that like that, by getting stuck into that particular storyline from the comics, they overlooked like all this great stuff that came before it that would have made a great movie too, I think one of the reasons why Grant Morrison's All-Star Superman was such a good book, is because, you know, he went back and got to the essence of the character, with all of those really cool sort of like Silver Age and elements and things like that. So Peters started off with a script called Superman Reborn.
Yes.
Yeah, Superman Reborn was written by
Kevin
Lemkin.
Smith was the first.
The first dude was Jonathan Lemkin.
Okay.
Yeah, Jonathan Lemkin had a script called Superman Reborn, and it had centered around the Doomsday thing, but then like some crazy thing happens, like Superman dies, and as he dies, he gives Lois Lane like a virgin birth.
Oh.
And she gives birth to a baby that grows up in 3 weeks and then becomes Superman again. And like it's just like some weird stuff, you know. It's totally bizarre. And then there was like another rewrite that has like Brainiac creating Doomsday, you know. There's just all of this really strange stuff, and it's not really going anywhere, and that's when they jump on Kevin Smith.
Well, Kevin Smith, who is a big and great part of this documentary, right? Like,
he's sort of the I wouldn't say that like he's sort of the star, you know, but I mean, he's the voice, you know. We've heard his story of this thing, at least as comic nerds, we've heard it for a long time.
For
him to finally sort of sit down and do sort of the definitive version of like his experience making it was really, really cool, because, you know, you heard all these stories and like you'd seen him quoted in some places. And like the one thing I love about this movie is how that it just sort of like cuts through the BS in a lot of areas and then totally confirms things that you thought had to be bullshit. You're like, no, that couldn't be true. This movie confirms it.
Yeah. And that's the thing with Kevin Smith, and the thing that I really have kind of always liked about him. A lot of people that I know give Kevin Smith a hard time, but for me, like, he's a really good storyteller, especially like on his podcast or whatever. And in this documentary, that comes to the forefront. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he's not shy about telling it the way it is, or the way that he perceived the way it was, you know,
right,
what I'm saying?
Right.
And he's very good at making it funny, you know what mm-hmm. I'm saying?
Absolutely.
But, but the thing that you know, and what's funny is I read you know, Kevin Smith's script is apparently online. I think I got a copy online like a long time ago, and I started trying to read that script ages ago, and I remember not being able to finish it because I thought it was, it seemed a little dry to me, and it seemed a little like, and I think even Kevin Smith says it in this documentary, is a little too like
it's not
inside
a good
baseball.
He's like, yeah, it's, you know, it was a comic lover's script, but like, you know, he was only, what, like 2-3 movies in?
Absolutely.
Chasing Amy, I think, had just been made, and, you know, he's like, yeah, like looking at it now, like, this was not, it wasn't a good script. It shouldn't have gone as far as it did.
Yeah. Well, which is funny because, I mean, even John Peters like says that about Kevin Smith, and Kevin Smith kind of admits it to himself. But it's, you know, Kevin, the thing is though, is that you've got somebody who's so passionate that the thing that kind of drives people like us crazy is that you've got somebody like Kevin Smith who is very smart, full of ideas, you know, very passionate about the subject matter, and how many people would not listen to him when story things started coming up, or the directives that he got to things to do to the script where he was like, what? And, you know, he really comes across as such a team player, you know, where he was like, all right, you want him to fight a polar bear? Okay.
Okay, yeah. He'll fight a polar bear.
Yeah, exactly.
Want a giant fucking spider? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, whatever, I'm here to write, you know, I'm here to, you know, enjoy the ride. And you know, it's really funny because there's all these, like, wacky things that apparently producer John Peters, mega producer at the time, still mega producer, you know, wanted in this script, which, you know, which you're just sitting there kind of like, what? And Peters, through his behavior and the things that he says in the documentary, kind of confirms, you know, like, oh yeah, that guy is crazy enough to maybe have possibly wanted these things. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. John Peters is larger than life.
Yes.
I mean, he is, if you were to sort of take the essence of the stereotypical Hollywood
producer,
like, producer,
yep,
and like distill it into like a fine brandy,
yeah,
and bottle it and like leave it on the shelf, that would be John Peters.
That
it, like, when he's at,
all he needs is a giant cigar.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you see him and you're just like, wow, I can't believe that, like, this guy exists in a way, you know, like he just it doesn't register. You're just like, wow, like this, it's amazing, because he sort of, like, what's cool about him is, like, he's a self-made man, you know? I mean, he was a hairdresser, you know?
He started off
as, like, a hairstylist, and, like, has basically, through force of will, become, like, a major Hollywood player. And, like, it's just impressive. You mean, you can't help but be impressed with the guy.
But you have to admit that in, at least in this documentary, who knows if we made him, he's definitely living in on another plane of reality.
He does not live in the same world.
He is living in a world where that bends to his will to a certain extent, that you know, things go his way, and not mean, not, you know, not as presented in this documentary.
No, he just genuinely believes that he knows the way it needs to go.
Yeah.
And, like, anything that doesn't sort of fall into that isn't good.
Yeah, because he's a street fighter, and he's been in, like, how many hundreds of street fights?
Hundreds of street fights.
That's one of the things that he says in the documentary.
Yeah, and I mean, and I guess he legitimately can, like, kick people's ass, you know? He's like a black belt.
So don't come after us for laughing at you.
But what's cool about this documentary is, like, I can't remember the last time, other than Lost Soul, that so many people who were involved with a project that, like, didn't get off the ground, were so open about their reasons, and they all agreed to come on camera and talk about it. And, I mean, it was amazing. I mean, when we saw it, the Peters interview had only taken place 3 weeks before the screening.
They had just gotten a chance to speak to him.
And what's amazing is that this, like, that's the interview that ties it all together.
Yeah, yeah. Without the John Peters interview, it definitely would not be as great a film as it is. You know,
it would be
I mean?
Half a movie.
Yeah.
It really would be half a movie.
Because you're only getting one side of the story, right? Yeah.
Right, right. You're only getting one side of the story, and you don't see for yourself, like, what kind of a figure he is.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I'm amazed that everything came together for this movie.
Yeah, I know.
And it's really, really a cool, like, just piece of work in terms of, like, documentary filmmaking, because, I mean, it just started off with the guy being interested in, you know, it's like, hey, like, how did this not happen?
Yeah.
How could this possibly not happen?
Well, that's the thing, is you really got to give kudos to the director, writer, you know, John Schnepp, right?
Right,
right. Who just, like you said, out of the kernel of an idea or wondering what happened, he just started poking around and was like, oh, this would make an amazing film. Like, this would make a great documentary. I have to make it. And,
yeah,
you know, at the screening that we saw, he got up and talked afterwards. Kevin Smith was there and got up and talked afterwards. Mm-hmm. But he got up and said, like, I think he was like, I was broke like two or three times during this. Like, I had no money. I was just pouring it all into this. And it's just like, wow, you got to give a guy like that respect.
Yeah, yeah, he was definitely obsessed with the story, and, you know, that comes through. And he talks to everyone from, you know, the stars. You know, Nicolas Cage isn't interviewed in the movie, but he does show up in, you know, the test footage, and you get an idea of, you know, sort of where he was going with that. But he talks to Tim Burton, Kevin Smith, like, all of the writers, John Peters.
Yeah.
You know, he manages to talk to, you know, all the artists, all the production artists who were developing the artists, like Brahm, Cary Gamble. I mean, like you see all of these people involved, you know, with the step, and you really get to, like, see sort of there. It is, it's sort of tantalizing as to, like, what the movie could have been.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And that's one of the most interesting things about this is that, like, yeah, you know, you're just like, wow, like, it would have been a train wreck, but it would have been a pretty magnificent train wreck.
Yeah, I don't know about that, man. Because there's a lot of, and this is where I go off the rails with this movie, because the thing that keeps recurring in this movie is that so many people are like, yeah, wouldn't it have been awesome to see Nicolas Cage as Superman? And it's like, yeah, like, Nicolas Cage is super, like, yeah, maybe like in an alternate universe or whatever, but I just think that this movie would have been at least that aspect of it, and the way that Tim Burton seemed to be going, and the way that the production was kind of spinning out of control. This thing could have been like a train wreck that just derailed superhero movies for years and years to come. Like, this thing just sounded like it was just spinning out of control. And, you know, from the first bit, from, you know, casting, would it be like entertaining and kind of like a mind-boggling way if there were no stakes involved and it was like a B movie or something? Sure, yeah. That would be entertaining. There's a lot of things that I would like to see that, you know, sound crazy, but I know I'm smart enough to not be like, you know, I'm going to put like, you know, freaking like Louis C.K. as Iron Man. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, there's just things that don't match. And the Nicolas Cage thing is one of them. But the other thing is just like, it just doesn't seem like this movie, even if it had come together, would have worked in any cognizant way. Yeah, would it have been something, would it have been a spectacle to behold? Yeah, but this is where I'm like, nah, I don't buy it. Like, a lot of people in this movie are like, oh, wouldn't it have been great? And I'm like, no, it wouldn't have been great. And if anything, this movie proves to me that, yeah, it wouldn't, it's good that it died. You know what I mean? Like, it's good that this did not happen. Now, the other thing that I have to say, and, you know, talking about a lot of the stuff that you see in this documentary, is that the talent involved, like the designers,
yeah,
a lot of the stuff that they did for Brainiac, a lot of the stuff that they, you know, some of the guys that designed the costume, Colleen Atwood, you know,
right,
what I mean?
Right.
The you know, the glowing suit that everyone thought, like, oh my God, like, freaked out about online, was only going to be in it for like, you know, what, a minute of film time or two. But then that's the thing, that's where I'm like, this is where it went wrong, because how much money did they spend on that suit? I don't remember the actual figure, but I want to say something like 60 grand or something, or for a suit that's on film for like 2 minutes. You know what I'm saying? So this is the sort of thing, again, with the 90s filmmaking, where things were a little out of control, nobody's reining anybody in, and it's kind of like, yeah, we've got a property, let's just go off to the races, you know what I mean?
Right,
there's no discipline. And to me, that's where this project, you know, say what you want about Superman Returns, say what you want about Man of Steel, you know, which we can say a lot of really bad things about them. I at least they seem to have like some sort of discipline behind them, where they knew what they wanted to do, and they kind of knew where they were going. Do I agree with the way that they've gone? No. But the death, Superman Lives, just sounded like like, as you watch this documentary and you see more and more interviews, especially with the screen rewrites and all that, you really see like, yeah, this wasn't going to go well, you know what I mean?
Movie making by corporation.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. And that was, I think, that's what Tim Burton sort of eventually got fed up with. And, you know, you saw like a bunch of examples in the 90s of what movie making by corporation produces. And, you know, granted, I think they've gotten,
even
you know,
still today.
I mean, still today. And, you know, it's gotten a little better, but you know, you still do get things that like they're clearly just made as product.
Yeah. But you know what's astounding though, as far as like you're talking about that? We're talking about Tim Burton here. We're talking about a dude who has probably
about the dude who made Pee-wee's Big Adventure, man.
Yeah. But we're talking about a guy who probably has more creativity in his little finger than I have in my whole body. A guy who directed and probably produced the second one, but directed two Batman movies that made millions of dollars. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Made people believe that, well, not necessarily me, but made people believe that Michael Keaton could play Batman. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So you would think that a studio would just be like, hey, man, it's all yours. Just, you know, do what you want. Go with it. And, you know,
you would think that, but no.
But no. And, you know, but to a certain extent, I'm kind of thankful about that, because, you know, Tim Burton also looked at the Kevin Smith script and, you know, didn't want to pull any elements of that. You know what I'm saying? And kind of went off his own way. But when you do see the design of the stuff, like the Brainiac stuff, the Krypton stuff, the, you know, a lot of, like, the things that Burton's team was working on, outside of the realm of like actual Superman, like the weird stuff, the monsters, the stuff that he excels at, that stuff is absolutely breathtaking. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's the stuff where I'd be like, keep that in the Superman movie, because it's so crazy cool. Like, you know, but then, you know, you've got ideas like, what is the one script that had, you know, Superman is sent to Earth with like a little robot companion or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's supposed to protect him when he's a baby or something.
Elrond.
No, that's from the Justice League. This is something else.
They were going to name it Elrond.
They were not. Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, there's a character called Elrond in the Justice League, but I don't think he was called Elrond. I think he was called, like, it was some weird name. But either way, like, once you start the script or the development starts spinning off into ideas like that that are so not even close. Well, it was supposed to be the Eradicator, right?
Right.
That was the original genesis of it, but they kind of made it cutesy and, you know, like it almost looked like, from what I remember, not exactly like Eve from WALL-E, but that sort of thing.
Yeah,
right? It was like a floating, you know, and so, you know, when you start to see ideas like that, it's just like your mind gets blown away, because you're like, what was actually going to show up in this? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, like they tried to tie so much of it to that horrible storyline of Death of Superman.
Yeah.
And you know, again, Death of Superman was one of those things too where it's like, who was in charge of that?
Yeah.
You know? You had Dan Jurgens writing some of it. You had, like, other people writing some of it. I mean, it was just...
I think Mike Carlin was the editor at the time, I believe. Yeah.
I just know that, like, it felt like it really felt like all over the place. And you know, granted, maybe that's just my memory of it because I haven't read the that stuff.
It was all over the place.
Years, but you know, by taking that as your primary example, it's not like you're really jumping on, you know, the most stable surface.
Exactly.
And that's the thing that really stuck with me out of this documentary. I mean, if you look at any of the people making it, like, no one ever appeared to be super
pumped
about making what they're making. And honestly, the person who seems the most excited about it seems to be Nicolas Cage.
I mean, Nicolas Cage, that's true.
In the moment that he's in, that, you know, in the things that you're seeing in the screen test, he really does seem to be thinking about the character, and he does seem genuinely excited to be playing Clark Kent and playing Superman, which is that was sort of a fascinating, you know, thing for me, because, you know, all we ever saw was that, you know, sort of that photograph, you know, with his eyes sort of half closed, you know, and it's just like, you know, it, you never really got the feeling that, you know, that he was really into it. And watching this, I'm like, oh yeah, he wanted to do this really bad.
That is, and that's unfortunate that they didn't have an interview with Nicolas Cage. I guess they tried to get him, but they couldn't. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is like, I will agree that, you know, Nicolas Cage was definitely passionate. They have a moment where he's kind of dressed up in like almost like 80s, like pastel, like suit, you know, where they're obviously trying to make Clark Kent like look as freakish, like freakishly nerdy as possible. Mm-hmm. And he says, he looks in the mirror, he's like, and they're all kind of like joking around and talking, and they're like, who would ever believe that this guy would be Superman? You know what I mean? And that's kind of like, you could see that he has insights to the character. But again, you know, the other insight that Nicolas Cage throughout the years, and, you know, Tim Burton, they approach the Superman character from the aspect of like, he's lonely, he's an outsider, he wants to be liked. And it's like they lose the altruism of the character. When you start trying to ground Superman in reality, like, you're losing the altruism of what he's supposed to stand for, which is like, I'm here, I'm one of you, let's all do this together, and I'm here to help. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Not this like loner bullshit. I mean, it's a good way to look at like an alternate version of Superman, in my opinion, but I am so tired. Ever since this movie, the Superman Lives, and these interviews came out, people keep trying to like tack that onto the character. I'm lonely, I'm sad. I'm like, really? You bullets bounce off your fucking skin.
Dude,
and
you can fly.
You know, what's there to be sad about? There's nothing to be sad about. You know what I mean? And so to me, it's like taking that, putting that sort of, adding that onto the character, glomming it on, is just such a thing of like, it's just like, it you don't get what the character's about. You don't get like what he's here to do. And you just don't get it. You know what I'm saying? And you know, I appreciate you and I and a lot of our comic geek friends, you know, were treated like shit growing up by peers, by adults, you know, whatever, and had that lonely thing. But Superman is not part of that. You know, Superman is the thing, especially me, that I looked at and was like, we can be better, you know? And so tacking that on is just like, it's just like, that was one of the things that wasn't going to work for
Superman,
me.
Superman, like, at least in my opinion, is sort of the, you know, he's sort of like the best that we could ever strive to be.
Yeah.
You know, he's sort of like the paragon of humanity.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, by making it, it's like, I don't want, you know, the best that we can be to be this like mopey sad sack, like, you know,
blah, blah, blah.
It's like, really, like, that's not the best we can do, you know? And so I totally get that, and that's one of the, I think that's one of the things that really worked about, you know, the Richard Donner, you know, Salkin things, at least in the first two movies, and even to a degree in the remake, the Superman Returns remake,
you know,
he's definitely like the guy who's trying to be the best. You know, I'd love to see a Superman movie that goes back to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And as would I. And it seems just like, I don't understand why writers can't wrap their brains around it. Like what is so hard about, and thankfully we have stuff like The Flash, but what is so hard about putting yourself in a place of joy and optimism and writing a script around that you have conflict, but you have a character who doesn't have to necessarily be conflicted about why he's doing something. You know what I mean? I don't get it. And as we've spoken, the Captain America movies have nailed that, you know?
They absolutely have. And, it's nice at least that somebody's doing it, even if they're not doing it with Superman, which seems like it would be sort of the obvious one.
Yeah.
But at least it is nice to see that some people are still doing it. I mean, and I think that's the great thing about Superman is as an idea, he's out there, even if it's not happening in the movies or the TV show, you'll have something like Alan Moore's Supreme or you'll have something Morrison's All-Star Superman, it's not going to go away, but damn, they sure do make it hard to find sometimes.
Yeah, they definitely do. But, and the one thing that I really want to say about this documentary too is, the modern version of Superman is, they got rid of the underpants, and they talk about the costume design a lot in this movie. And, they also wanted to get rid of the overpants, back then. They were can we just get rid of that? And, there's this constant misunderstanding of the design of that costume, which is why does he have underpants on? And I'm it's all about color blocking, dude. It breaks up the blue, and you have this blotch of red that, so he's not just one giant drab of a dark color. You know what I'm saying? He's got a little yellow. He's got, and even in this movie, an Oscar-winning costume designer, Colleen Atwood, right, says towards the end of the movie that we had to put the underpants back on because it's about the color. And even in the Nicolas Cage costume, which I think they went a little crazy because it ended up looking like a Speedo over the suit, but they decided that they had to have that red in there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, their implementation of it was a little ridiculous. But, to me, I was like, aha! I'm sitting in the theater and I'm very much like, aha! Yeah. I'm right, And that's the thing is that costume has endured through the 60s, through the 70s, through the 80s, through, for the longest time. And they've changed it now, and it's just kind of
Here's the crazy thing, too, is that, man, people always keep having the same goddamn bad ideas about Superman. Yeah. It's like, oh, let's take away his flying.
Yeah,
he doesn't need to fly. He didn't fly when he started. Let's take away the flying.
Let's
figure out a way to depower him. Oh, let's take away the red underpants. I mean, like it's always the same damn things that people keep doing.
Superman Lives. Yeah, no, I totally, I'm with you. You're right. And it's like they keep doing the same thing instead of looking at the stuff that works. You know what I mean? And the thing is that there, like I said before, there would have been a lot of stuff that worked in this movie, but it's like when you've got the central character kind of wrong, which it seems to me, even though, Nicolas Cage has enthusiasm for it, even though you've got Tim Burton, who's a very smart, creative mind, even though once you've kind of lost the core of what that guy is, then you can throw as many as Man of Steel has proven to me, as, Superman Returns has proven to me. You can throw as many effects, as many set pieces, as many fights, as many crazy things in there as you want. But once you've kind of lost that core of who this dude is, then you're lost. It's just gone.
It's empty spectacle, and no one's going to want to watch that.
Exactly.
I mean, which is. Yeah, I mean, you see, going back to our last podcast about Mad Max. I mean, the reason why it works is because they're still selling that character. You know, I mean, it's all about the character. So that's why the action works so well.
Yeah.
If you don't give people, someone to believe in, then they're not going to want to watch your movie.
Yeah, exactly. But this documentary I don't want to make it seem I'm trashing the idea of Superman Lives, but this documentary is fantastic.
Like, yeah, I mean,
can't
because
say enough about it.
I mean, again, like the man, the director. Yeah, what's his name again?
John Shep.
John Shep. Like
Schnepp. Schnepp.
Schnepp. Sorry. You know, he just. I mean. Honestly, he was more passionate about this idea than anyone ever was about the, you know, the Death of Superman movie. And he's so thorough and he's very inventive visually. He actually recreates some of the bits of the script, you know, either through animation or through, you know, like sort of a staged, you know, his own little staging of it. You know, I mean, he keeps it very interesting and it's not a bland bunch of talking heads at all. This is a movie that, you know, is really fun to watch.
Yeah.
You know? I wish that sort of like all documentaries had this sort of, you know, visual inventiveness going on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's really interesting because I don't think the trailer does this movie justice because
I agree.
Us seeing the trailer and thinking like, ooh, this looks like it could be bad. And then one of our friends who went with us, his name is Doug, he was like, oh no, I have a friend, and he was actually one of the Kickstarter supporters. He's like, I have a friend that saw it and he says it's really good. So like when we went to go see it, my expectations weren't like super high, but you know, I was like, okay. And then I really ended up being kind of like blown away by the whole experience because it really is a warts and all, you know, the access that this guy gets, you know, the candor that everyone has in it is really kind of like, you know, eye-opening. You're just sort of like, wow, man.
Yeah, and again, what's nice too is that people were just open about what happened.
Yeah.
And they weren't necessarily afraid of like offending each other at this point. You know, it's all sort of water under the bridge.
Yeah.
You know, I think enough time has passed that, you know, feelings aren't still hurt over stuff like this.
Yeah.
And you know, I think for anybody who sort of is interested in making movies that this is really important to watch, you know, because like you see how a lot of this stuff, you know, that seems incredibly personal, a lot of these decisions, you know, where people are fired or people are, you know, let go, people are, you know, against each other and it seems incredibly personal, but a lot of it's not, you know, and a lot of it is just, you know, sort of the business of what it is. And you know, it in a way, it's a really sort of inspiring movie about filmmaking, even though it's a project that never happens.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is very much like the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune.
Yeah, which, yeah.
Have you seen that?
Fantastic movie.
Yeah, an absolutely astounding film where it's like you're very much intrigued by what could have been, but like there's so much interesting stuff in there that it ends up being sort of inspiring in a way.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I think you could look at The Death of Superman Lives. Some people might be like, "Oh, this is kind of depressing," but to me, it wasn't really depressing at all because.
Well, yeah, you have to see where things are going, and that's the one thing about Jodorowsky's Dune, which it's super. Again, fabulous documentary. People have got to see that.
That like one's you see, really inspiring.
You see Alien born out of that movie. I mean, you see sort of the modern science fiction movement, you know, happen because of this.
Exactly.
And, you know, with this one, with like, you know, because this Superman movie failed, you know, granted it set back the superhero movie for a while, but then when they sort of started coming back, I mean, people... In a way, it ended up making the modern superhero movie because people were intent on not doing that. They were like, okay, we're not going to do Batman and Robin. We're not going to do Superman, you know, Death of Superman. We're going to do something that's different, something that's better.
Well, what's interesting, you know, I mean, they show a clip of like the Nicolas Cage like flight test in there, and just seeing that. That technology, I think it was ILM that worked
right,
on it,
right.
maybe? Yeah, just seeing that technology, you know, the flight thing was like, whoa, they could do that back then?
It was pretty impressive.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive. And the thing is like, just to see how much creativity was going to go into this thing, I mean, in a way, it's like, wow, you know, when, you know, forces are moving behind a project, it's pretty crazy to see, like, the way it goes. But the other thing is, you know, where the Jodorowsky's Dune, like, inspired, like, all these other and these great artists to move on to other things that were great, the thing and that I kind of alluded to before is that, and what we said before, is, like, so many bad ideas from this project still cling to Superman projects down the line. And it's like, and I just, you know, the idea of the loner and, you know, that he's, you know, that he, you know, the underpants, the, oh, he's not cool, you know, so we have to change all this. Like, so much of that stuff has just clung on to the development of different Superman movies. And it's just like, when are the barnacles going to get stripped off of that? And so that we can, you know, get the wholesome sort of like inspirational character that, you know, right now I think the world kind of needs, right? So
yeah.
But that's the thing, is on the other hand, you've got, I mean, even just the story behind the creation of this documentary is inspiring. I mean, John Schnepp, you know, the guy goes out, he hunts down interviews, he just has a passion for it, and just the final product, that this movie exists, that we can go and go like, hey, look at all these crazy things that happened to a Superman movie that was never made, you know, that some people think might have been fascinating, you know, that to me is inspiring in and of itself, right? And that this guy put everything on the line, you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, you know, he said in the interview, like afterwards, that they had no money to go interview Tim Burton with. Like, they had to fly to London to be able to interview Tim Burton, you know, and they didn't even know for sure that they were going to get in. Like, it was just come to London, wait and see, and they had to borrow money from a friend to do that. Like, that's just crazy. Like, the dedication. And then the other thing that I love about this documentary is when you do see Tim Burton, he's still squirming about the experience when they ask him.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
It's definitely, you know, sort of the touchiest subject with him. I think because, you know, because it's hard for him to let go of projects.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you really get the, you know, because even now, you know, it's something that, like, it's moved on. It's, you know, it's done. It's water under the bridge. But, like, talking about it, you can still sort of see, like, the lighting up behind the eyes. It's like, oh, well, you know, maybe this, you know, maybe. And that's one of the things that I found most interesting is that, you know, even though this is something that's done, it continues to influence these people's creative lives pretty much for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like it was something that was in development for a long time, you know, that they were just moving forward on. And you know, much like anything else, when something falls apart, it definitely still remains a part of you, you know? I mean, all those artists did that work, you know, and their recall was just absolutely fascinating, you know? I mean, the stuff that all of them would talk about, like working in, you know, working on the designs. And I love the bit about the one guy who said that, like, John Peters would like to bring his girlfriend or his family or whatever in and, like, impress them and, you know, order people around and actually might have put a guy, like, in a headlock or something, or, like,
yeah, yeah. And then you go to Peters and he's like, oh yeah, of course I did that. I was just trying to build morale.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what? By beating up on the staff? And yeah, and how a lot of the designers just, like, would have to go along with it because, like, it's John Peters. I want to keep my job. You know what I mean? So yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it sounds like a project that was kind of almost insane from the beginning. And, you know, fortunately for me, doomed to failure, you know.
Yeah,
But I'm glad that the death of Superman Lives, What Happened, was not doomed to failure, because, you know, I think that this you know, could have been that this documentary could have been a crash and burn, but it's not, you know, it actually soars.
He really pulled it off and, you know, did a spectacular job. And I really hope that this one gets a long life.
Yeah. Me too. And if you are, you know, if you are fans of it, of this sort of thing out there listening, and you're interested in this thing, track it down. I know that, like, as of our recording, it's going to be available for pre-order tomorrow. We're recording on June 8th. June 9th is when it's going to be available for pre-order at their site, and it's www.tdoslwh.com. And you should order this documentary if you're into comics, if you're into filmmaking. I mean, I can't recommend it enough. I think it was a really fun ride, despite the fact that it talked about a film that I never really wanted to see made, but apparently a lot of people think might have been a good idea. I don't know.
Yep. Look, it definitely changed the movie landscape because it is sort of like the biggest scale crash and burn, you know, in a long time, and certainly the most public one. And, you know, I think anybody who's interested in comics, anybody who's interested in filmmaking, and or even anybody who's interested in sort of the creative process at all would find this thing fascinating.
Yeah. But isn't it, you know what's even more fascinating? Now you mentioned that it's kind of like one of the bigger crash and burns of the last, you know, however long, you know, that everyone kind of walks away from this thing almost unscathed. You know what I'm saying? Like, their careers aren't ruined. Nobody's thrown into the gutter. Yeah. Nobody stops working as a designer. Nobody stops working as a producer. You're talking about a project that was like already like millions of dollars had gone into it, and it falls apart.
I think the lesson here is, if you have plenty of blame to spread around, that's a good thing. And the other lesson is, failure is always an option.
I guess so. Well, for me, it's a great line that Bobcat Goldthwait said on an interview a long time ago. He said, "Never be afraid to quit something." And I was like, wow, you never hear that sort of thing. And I mean, these people were kind of driven into the ground by this project, but it sounds like a lot of people should have never been afraid to quit, you know, while the going was ahead, you know. It's just fascinating because I'm obviously, Superman is a character that's like near and dear to my heart, or has been, you know, and it's just crazy because, like, you don't want successful people to fail, but the way that I saw this project going, I was like, I'm so glad that it fell apart. You know, as cruel as that sounds, I'm very glad that this Superman movie was not made. People will disagree with me, but at least this documentary gives us a taste of what was happening and all the creativity that went into it and some of the passion from certain different departments that went into it. And for me, that's enough to see, like, okay, this is kind of crazy. In the Q&A, what I would be interested in seeing in the Q&A after the movie, somebody asked a question and said, could they ever produce this like as an animated film, like a one shot? And that I might be interested in seeing because, as I said, a lot of the development artwork and stuff was beautiful stuff. You can't deny it, you know?
Yeah.
So seeing an animated version, like maybe Bruce Timm directing or something like that, those straight to DVD, you know, DC things that I just buy unseen because I'm a maniac. Like, I would love to see that sort of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be interesting. So, I don't know. I think this goes with the Death of Superman Lives, What Happened is probably a really great, our highest recommendation goes to this. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that everybody should go out and download it legally.
Yes.
When you can.
Yeah. And again, available for pre-order at www.tdoslwh.com. And you will be happy that you checked it out because you're not going to believe some of the crap that went through this. this movie that this movie went through. Went through this movie and this movie went through. Any last thoughts, Paul, on this outstanding documentary?
No, other than the fact that I think we should call out that it was like a part-time fanboy field trip that night.
It was.
It was a whole bunch of us. It was you and I and Liad and Doug.
Yes.
And we just had a fantastic time.
Yes, and we need to do more of those. So, great. Well, this has been the Death of Superman Lives What Happened episode of Part-Time Fanboy. I am Christian Horn, and I'm here with my fellow Kryptonian, Paul Edwards, and
yes.
Next week we're going to be talking about another documentary, which, give him a taste, Paul, what is it?
Let's just say it's another documentary about a very spectacular failure.
Yes.
This one in the horror genre.
Yes. Okay, great. We'll leave it at that, and we'll leave the listeners to figure it out. So thanks for listening, and tune in next week for our chat of, you're not going to want to miss this one, because this one's great. I mean, I couldn't believe what I was watching. In any case, be back here next week for another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Bye.
Bye.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing. I'm doing part-time. Part-timefanboy.com.